Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
Did the RCMP break the law over data for the Long Gun Registry? The Information Commissioner is recommending charges and slamming the government for retroactively changing the laws to avoid problems. Commissioner Suzanne Legault tells us why she believes this sets a perilous precedent.
The Liberal plan for the middle class has been under scrutiny for what critics say is incorrect math and misleading tax benefits. There's no better person to address these issues than Liberal leader Justin Trudeau, who joins us on the show.
A report from CBC claims the Chief of Defense Staff ordered his senior officers to ignore key recommendations from a scathing report on sexual harassment in the military. That report was prepared after an expose in McLean's. To weigh in on the issue, we speak with retired Colonel, now lawyer, Michelle Drapeau.
There's a debate over the election debates. Three of the four major parties have all agreed to take part in a debate hosted by McLean's and Rogers. But one of them, the governing Conservatives, has also rejected the traditional televised consortium debate. The McLean's panel addresses the controversy and talks about new environmental targets from the federal government.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. This week, Canada's Information Commissioner tabled a special report about the federal long gun registry and access to information, revealing that almost 2 months ago, she recommended charges be laid against the RCMP. Now, on top of that, she's sounding the alarm over the way the federal government is dealing with this, saying it sets a perilous precedent. Commissioner Suzanne Legault was recommending the charges against the Mounties because they withheld and destroyed gun registry data, even though there had been access to information requests to obtain it. But what's more disturbing to Legault is that buried in the Fed's omnibus budget bill is a measure that rewrites the access to information law and backdates the changes so that the RCMP would never be accused of breaking the law. Now, the Prime Minister and his government say the Mounties were only respecting the will of Parliament to destroy the registry data, and this new legislation is just to close up a loophole.
Legault is concerned with this move, saying if the Conservatives are allowed to retroactively change the law, there is nothing stopping future parliamentarians from doing the same. To talk more about this serious issue, I'm joined on the phone by Information Commissioner Suzanne Legault. So, Commissioner, if you could sort of just walk us through what exactly the situation is here, And sort of how we got to this point. You know, a request was made for information from what used to be the Long Gun Registry, and now we find ourselves here. Sort of what happened in between those two events?
Okay, well, really, if you look at the special report, you have a pretty good chronology of how events unfolded. But essentially what happened is there was a request that was made in March of 2012, which was a few weeks before the Ending the Long Gun Registry Act came into effect, which was in April 2012. And of course, we had requests, and we were aware of requests, and we had some complaints open, so I wrote to the Minister of Public Safety at the time, about a week after the Ending the Long Gun Registry came into effect, to ensure that the minister was going to preserve the records and ensure that the RCMP was going to preserve the records that were responsive to requests, including for all the time for investigations and for any related proceedings. And Minister Taves at the time gave me those assurances. And the reason that we did that is because the Ending the Long Gun Registry did not oust the jurisdiction of the Access to Information Act. And so the Access to Information Act applied. Notwithstanding that, in October of 2012, the RCMP proceeded with the destruction of the Long Gun Registry, to the exception of the Quebec records, because there was an ongoing court case. We got a complaint on that specific request. We investigated, and we came to the conclusion that not all of the records that should have been provided to the complainant were provided to him. Hence, we recommended to the minister, which is now Minister Blaney, in March of 2015, that those additional records, which were contained in the Quebec Registry, which had been preserved, at the very least, those should be provided to the complainant, and they should be treated in accordance with the Access Act, should any exemptions apply. At the same time, I referred the matter to the Attorney General of Canada because I found evidence of the possible commission of an offense under Section 67.1 of the Access to Information Act. Now, on May 7th, the government tabled the Budget Implementation Bill, C-59, which contained provisions which would retroactively oust the application of the Access to Information Act back to October 2011, when the Ending the Logon Registry Act was actually tabled in Parliament. So that is essentially the situation.
And so what would that mean for this complainant exactly? What, you know, this outstanding complaint that has been made about whether or not the government offered the information that it should have, what would happen to that complaint?
Well, essentially, the consequences of the bill, if it comes into effect, one could really look at it as if it has a threefold effect. The first level, really, is the right of the complainant to obtain the records that we have concluded were responsive to his records, were responsive to his request. A lot of them were destroyed in October 2012. But there are the records that remain, and those should be provided to the complainant. Now, the government, the RCMP, and the minister essentially replied to me and said they were not going to provide those additional records. So we filed an application in federal court yesterday for an order that the government actually disclose those remaining records to the complainant, subject to any applicable exemptions under the Act. So that's the first level. The rights of the requesters at this point have not been fulfilled, and we also have the referral to the Attorney General for an investigation as to determine whether or not the records that were destroyed with a willful intent to deny the rights of the requester. So that's the first level. The second level is really about this bill itself and what it purports to do and whether or not this is legal to have such a bill with such a retroactive application, and whether it is constitutional, whether it infringes, for example, freedom of expression under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom, and thirdly, whether there is an infringement of the constitutional principle of the rule of law. So that's the second level. And then the third level is really what kind of precedent is the government setting with such a piece of legislation when it actually puts forward a bill that would retroactively negate the application of a law with its protection for some vested rights under the Access to Information Act in a situation where they are seized with my referral with evidence of a potential criminal offense. So what kind of precedent is that setting for our democratic society? So essentially that is the potential consequences of this bill.
Is it your belief that some of the information that this individual should have rightfully received under the Access to Information Act, is it your belief that some of that information has been destroyed or no longer exists?
That's correct.
So to put this, you know, I guess one of the counterarguments, or maybe a counterargument to this, would be, well, Parliament intended for that information to be destroyed, for the Act, for the Long Gun Registry to be taken away. Why shouldn't that take precedence over everything else?
Well, because the will of Parliament, as it is existing at this time, is the Ending the Long Gun Registry Act. And the Ending the Long Gun Registry Act never ousted the application of the Access to Information Act. It dealt with some issues with the Privacy Act and the Library and Archives Act, but the Ending the Long Gone Registry Act was and is still silent on the issue of the application of the Access to Information Act. That is the act that was passed by Parliament in April of 2012. Now, you know, I have to apply the Access to Information Act, the rights of requesters under the Access to Information Act are in existence. And that is the only will of Parliament that I have to act upon. That is the law. That is the law that was passed in 2012. That is the law that is in existence. And that is the law that was in existence throughout this entire series of events. That is the law that applied to everyone that acted during that period of time.
And in so what would you, I assume your preferred response at this point would be for that part of the act to be that part of this new legislation to be taken out entirely. Like, I assume it's not, from your view, fixable in any way. It kind of has to be taken out in its entirety.
Those provisions?
Yeah, the provisions in the budget. Yes, in the budget bill.
Well, yes, because if the government's intent is to fix a loophole, then I think they can just do that as of now. What we have in those provisions is a retroactive application to a time when the Ending the Long Gone Registry Act did not even exist, in the context where the government is seized with my referral.
That was Information Commissioner Suzanne Legault speaking about the government, the RCMP, and the Long Gun Registry.
Since releasing his plan for the middle class, Liberal leader Justin Trudeau has faced criticism from the governing Conservatives, the NDP, and even some economists. This plan is going to be the key platform piece for the party heading into the fall election, and the Grits are hoping to gain votes from middle-class families.
Liberals aim to reduce the income taxes for people who make between $45,000 and $89,000 a year and raise taxes for anyone making more than $200,000 a year. The Conservatives call it the Trudeau tax. The Liberals are also planning to make changes to childcare benefits, scrapping the Conservative benefits and replacing them with a single tax-free benefit that they say will give struggling families hundreds, or in some cases thousands, of more dollars per year.
But some say those numbers just don't add up and the Liberal math is wrong. I touched base with Liberal leader Justin Trudeau to get his response to the criticisms. Let's start off with your plan on income taxes. You frame it as a tax for the rich to give to the middle class, but a new study from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and it's backed up by a number of other economists, shows that the tax system may not exactly be that. They frame it as saying that it actually takes a lot from the top 5%, which is true, but in terms of the rest of the money that Canadians will be able to take home, at the end of the day, it's the next 15% that actually benefits the most, not the 40 to 80% on the income scale like your party is claiming. So how do you square up your numbers?
Well, the numbers are simple. We're giving a $3 billion tax break of 1.5 points, that's 7% from 22 to 20.5 on incomes that in the income range of $44,000 to $89,000 a year. This is because we know that people are facing tough choices. But to be fiscally responsible, we're actually bringing in a new bracket on the 1% of Canadians who are doing the best, because asking Canadians who've done well to do a little more to help is appropriate in this time where people are really, really worried about not just their own future, but their kids' future.
And you know, the richest of the rich will get dinged, that's for sure, under your plan. The CCPA study says that they'll be dinged about $3,302 more in a year, and that's what they'll feel. But the 80 to 94% of earners will be the biggest benefits when it comes to take-home pay. They'll get between $262 and $524. According to this study, though, between 40 and 80% of the earners in Canada will only see benefits of about $46 maximum. So that doesn't seem like, you know, a lot of money going to the middle class. It seems like it's the still some of the richer people getting more cash to take home.
You know, it's interesting because this plan has been criticized by the right as asking too much of the wealthy, and it's been criticized from the left as not doing enough for the people who need it. You know, we're focused on being fiscally responsible and establishing a little more opportunity and a little more fairness to our tax system. And this is only, of course, half the plan. The other half of the plan is to bring in a significantly improved child benefit for middle-class families with kids and for people working hard to join the middle class. This is about making sure that we're restoring that sense of fairness and opportunity to Canadians at a time where Mr. Harper for 10 years has been giving extra benefits and tax breaks that favor the wealthy.
Your party fully admits that $2 billion so far is unaccounted for, which you promised to explain a little bit later. But the Conservatives are claiming that your math is just wrong. And the Conservatives, along with Jack Mintz from the University of Calgary, say that the Liberals failed to take into account $1 billion in revenue under the existing child benefit measures. Did you take that $1 billion into account?
Absolutely. We totally did. And this this government is, as we've seen, just flailing at our plan, because our plan is simple, meaningful, tax-free, and more generous to the Canadians who need it right across the board. A family making $90,000 a year with two kids, which is right in the median, is going to get a $490 check every month, tax-free, and that'll make a really big difference in the lives of an awful lot of people. The Conservatives can't attack it on that, particularly because their plan is taxable, so the money that that family would get through the Conservative plan ends up being taxed at the end of the year, and that's not the kind of help that they need. So we used the Finance Department numbers, their own published numbers, to cost out our plan, and now they're just trying to flail and put forward completely erroneous arguments to try and attack this plan because they don't have anything better to say.
You've committed a lot of funds to these measures, and I want to talk about infrastructure and public transit, something every city has been asking the federal government to increase and help them out with. But how do you plan to increase infrastructure spending and public transit investment when a lot of the money you've freed up has already been spent and $2 billion is still unaccounted for?
I have been talking about the need to invest substantially in infrastructure for 2 years now. It's at the heart of what we're going to be doing as a government, and it's something that that I am very excited to talk about in the coming months. The fact is, Canada needs that, and we have a government right now that has cut over the past 2 years, each of the 2 years, 90% from the Building Canada Fund, infrastructure fund that cities and provinces need to actually help people get to work on time and safely. So, like I said, when we roll out our full platform, people will see serious commitments to infrastructure, to housing, to post-secondary education, to seniors. It will be fully costed, it will be responsible, and it will be in balance.
The Globe and Mail is reporting that the Liberal plan is going to be to entice large pension funds to spend big on Canadian infrastructure projects. Is that a plan?
Well, we have world-class pension funds that are investing in infrastructure around the world, whether it's bridges in Scandinavia or high-speed rail projects elsewhere around the world. These are funds that have a level of expertise and understanding in the kinds of long-term investments, and they haven't been investing much in Canada. Now, the first priority is, of course, making sure that they are good investments, because we want to protect our pension funds and our pensioners, but I think there are a lot of different ways of accessing different kinds of capital that are going to help us meet those needs. But obviously, the government's going to have a direct role as well, stepping up and providing stable, long-term, predictable funding to our municipalities and our provinces to make sure that we're meeting our infrastructure needs. So, as with many things, there will be a blend of solutions that will work for Canada.
I'm just wondering, how is it that you will entice large pension funds to spend in Canada rather than abroad? And isn't that risky, given the fact that, you know, they could just choose not to?
Oh, that's what I highlighted. But I mean, in conversations with many people in very different areas, I've seen an opening and an interest there. And we all want to see Canada do better. We all know that investing in infrastructure is both good in the short term because it creates great jobs and stimulates growth, but also allows for greater productivity and growth in the long term as well. So this is something that that we're looking forward to bringing forward as a responsible plan, and we'll have a lot more to say about it in the coming weeks and months.
That was Liberal leader Justin Trudeau responding to criticisms about his tax plan for the middle class.
Still to come on the show, we speak with a retired colonel about reports the Chief of Defense Staff ordered officers to ignore recommendations about sexual harassment in the military, and the Maclean's panel speaks about the election debates and new environmental targets from the feds.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we discuss the controversy around the federal election debates and new environmental targets from the feds. But first,
there's been a major development this week on the issue of sexual harassment in the military. The CBC obtained an internal document that shows the Chief of Defense Staff may have ordered his senior officers to ignore key recommendations from a scathing report about sexual assault and harassment in the armed forces. The document is called an initiating directive, and it came out after the CDS received a draft copy of the report prepared by a former Supreme Court justice. The scathing report found that there was a culture of sexual misconduct in the military and that there were systemic problems in dealing with complaints.
The findings were similar to last year's exposé from Maclean's and L'Actualité that prompted the whole investigation. But in the directives from the CDS, it tells senior officers to disregard recommendations for an independent body to be created to investigate future complaints. In fact, it says, quote, "The current sexual misconduct investigation and justice system authorities will remain unchanged," end quote. That would effectively force complainants to go back to the same chain of command that the report says failed the victims in the first place. The CDS released a statement later saying these were only preliminary assumptions and any suggestions they were orders are false.
The military and government originally refused to commit to an independent body, but that changed in question period Wednesday when the NDP's Jack Harris questioned Defense Minister Jason Kenney.
Will he guarantee that the Canadian Armed Forces establish an independent body to handle sexual misconduct, yes or no?
That's a good question.
The Honourable Minister of National Defense.
Yes.
So with that simple and practically inaudible yes, the government has now committed to an independent process. To talk more about this whole issue, I'm joined by Michel Drapeau, a former colonel in the Army who is now a lawyer with an expertise in military law.
So first off, have you seen the documents that CBC has
yes,
been
I have.
Talking about? You have.
I have seen the documents.
So what was your initial impression?
I did have a problem fundamentally with the issue itself because, in fact, my first reaction is, at long last, we have somebody in the position, the Chief of the Defense Staff is going to take ownership of it. I was happy with the initiative itself, the fact it came under his pen, and the fact he would not guess and let his staff tell him what needs to be done, but he instead give guidance, give direction to his staff, this is the way we're going to go and how far we're going to go. But as soon as I turned a couple of pages, then my face went from having a happy smile to being very, very disappointed, because under the heading of assumption, one of the assumptions, I can't remember if it was assumption one or two, but it was one of the top assumptions, was in clear language, there will be no change to the military justice system. And the second one is there will be no loss of jurisdiction to the military police ability to conduct investigation of sexual complaint nature. And this is, I mean, right off the bat, basically, he said, I'm going to cut off any suggestion that we're going to be sharing jurisdiction with anybody else, knowing fully well that the very raison d'etre of the report of Madame Deschamps and what, in fact, above all, what she recommended was that did be an outside external body. And the reason why this was required was because she recognized, after having spoken to 700 individuals during her one-year study, that there was a fundamental lack of trust into the military justice system and into the military police, so much so that the vast majority of victims do not report the crimes, and hence DND and the Canadian Forces are either not aware what is taking place, and if they are aware, they're not taking any step to it. And yet, basically, right off the bat, the CDS were slamming the door shut because he has the authority to do that. On the wristband, it becomes an order to everybody within the organization, we will not do that. So it was a foregone conclusion from that moment onwards that the recommendation, the key recommendation of Madame Deschamps will not be followed, and at the very best, it will give lip service to it because that will not go anywhere. So it went from being, I was happy that leadership has been exerted, to, oh my God, what have we got here?
So you mentioned that these were orders. And this is another issue that's popped up about what exactly it was. This is an initiating directive from the CDS. And the CDS said in a statement after the story came out that any suggestion that these were orders is false. And he's suggesting that he is not interfering in any way with the work being done by General Whitecross to try and determine what the best route is forward on, the issue or the recommendation of an independent body. So if you can you explain what an initiating directive is? And when it comes from the CDS, in your eyes, is it orders to his senior staff?
Listen, I've acted as the executive secretary at National Defense Headquarters for a while. And some of these initiating directives, and they can take various names and various format, are basically have existed as long as we've had armed forces and written orders. A directive or orders are synonym of one another. When a chief of the defense staff, who is empowered under the Code of Service Discipline, and is in fact the sole authority to provide directive, guidance, orders, and so on and so forth to his staff, when he takes a pen and he signs that, he has expressed his will, expressed his wish, expressed the way in his vision and how he wants this report and what he wants to have for the organization as a whole. Everybody, in fact, are taking their cue from what the CDS would have said, in this case, what he would have written. After careful consideration, those are the words that he used. So that would only confirm that this is the defense or the chief of defense staff policy and certainly instructions, directive, and orders to anybody who would read this material. So to me, and as an ordinary soldier, and I served for 34 years, I'm sorry. If I read this, I am certainly impressed by the term directive. And that's what it is, initiating directive. How are we going to be responding? How will D&D as a body take those recommendations, and what do we intend to do with it? What are the parameters? And here's the CDS has clearly established that, and he has established that none of these recommendations that in any way affect the military justice system or the military police will be given the time of day, will see the light of day, or will be in any way, shape, or form put into order.
So when the CDS expresses his will in a written format like this, that, in your eyes, is an order?
To that, I am absolute. A particularly a document that reads, directive, the cast was set. It was set almost a year before when you give the mandate to Madame Deschamps, and it was just a continuation of it. So to me, 1 + 1 sometimes equate 3, but in this occasion, 1 + 1 = 2, and this is the clear resounding 2. The CDS had given instruction, order, direction, call it what you want. That is, to my frame of mind, black and white.
Do you have any faith in the system moving forward? Mind you, that the defense minister has now said in the House of Commons that he's committed to an independent body. So do you have any faith that that will be dealt with properly, and what needs to happen next?
Let me answer your last question first. What needs to happen next, the solution is so simple, it evades most of us. In 1998, until 1998, the Canadian Armed Forces did not have jurisdiction to either investigate or to prosecute sexual assault. Did not have it. That belonged to the civil authority. Civil authority, as we speak, have got exclusive jurisdiction to look after murder. That's where we had Russell Williams tried by a civilian court. By manslaughter and kidnapping of children. It was slipped in into a massive amendment to the National Defense Act without any discussion, any consideration in committee in the House, that all of a sudden the Canadian forces were found with having jurisdiction over sexual assault. That could be done, a simple amendment, two words, and we'll change that. And from here on in, a victim of a sexual assault, it matters not if he has any confidence in the military justice system, because the victim would call 911 and the RCMP or the provincial police or the municipal police would come as the independent, external, trained police force and investigate it, and then ultimately lay charges where they need to be laid in a civilian court. That's the solution to it. To answer your first part, do I have confidence that the military can do it? No, I don't. I'm beyond that point. I've written back in June 2013, nothing has been done. McLean magazine has done a front page covers, in fact, three covers back in 2008, and nothing has been done. In fact, it's before that. I think it's 1998, I think it's the...
That was the first report. One on rape in the military.
That's right.
Yeah.
And nothing has been done. We could solve this, cure this overnight, small amendment that could be voted in matters of hours. And end of discussion. Otherwise, I'm afraid we're going to be back having the same discussion in weeks or months from now. It just won't go away. And creating an external center, in some ways, it will have, fundamentally after the report is being done, it will have to be brought back in before a court-martial. And I don't think a level of trust that victims don't have at the moment would necessarily improve over time. I don't think so. I don't see it.
That was Michel Drapeau, a former colonel in the Army who is now a lawyer with an expertise in military law. He was discussing the latest developments about the report on sexual misconduct in the military.
Still to come, the McLean's panel discusses the debate over the election debates and the government's ambitious new environmental targets.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. And I'm joined this week by political editor for McLean's, Paul Wells. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Hi, how are you?
It's a bit of a unique situation where our panel is just two people.
It's cozy.
All right, so we'll start off with the debate about the debates. And this week, McLean's got some good news. We had thrown out the challenge to party leaders saying, listen, we want to do a different style of debate, maybe over the summer, to really get the leaders out there talking about their platforms, because we all know the campaign begins after the spring sitting ends. Mm-hmm. And we have the NDP, the Green Party, and the Conservatives all accepting the invitation. The Liberals, I spoke with Justin Trudeau on the phone. He said that he's not counting it out. He's not saying yes. All options are basically open. So what exactly is your plan for the debates? I know you're very involved in all of this. And do we have a date yet? What's coming up next?
We don't have a date yet. We are still hoping to secure the... We're having good discussions with the Liberal Party, with folks around Justin Trudeau, and we're hoping to secure their participation. And then we will, at that point, we will talk about potential dates. I think basically in the dead middle of summer, for a nationally televised debate that would be moderated by a single moderator. So far, it looks like it might be me, and with all four of the national leaders, That's not, of course, the only development this week. The Conservatives said they will also accept an invitation from Bloomberg for a one-hour business or economy-oriented debate. And I'm given to understand that there's a good chance that the Conservatives will be naming other invitations that they'll be accepting over the next little while.
Because they said up to five debates they're willing to take part in.
Yeah. And, I mean, it opens up. There's a good chance that the however long the debate period is, probably 2 months, will be a bit of a mess, where there'll be some leaders showing up for some debates and other leaders showing up for other debates and not always overlapping. We're going to get to try different formats and different venues and different instigators for these debates, rather than everyone sitting around waiting for this committee of three television networks to decide what's going to happen.
All right, and you brought up this committee, the consortium, and another thing that took headlines is the fact that the Conservatives said no to the consortium, said they didn't want to take part. Now, the deal was four debates in total, two in English, two in French, and the Conservatives said no, thank you, and that's CBC, CTV, and Global. What do you make of the fact that they turned their backs on the traditional way to do these debates? I mean, the consortium's been running the debates. Rogers has been a part at one point of the consortium. They've turned their back on what Canadians expect out of debates during election periods.
Yeah, Canadians expect what has recently been going on until it stops going on, and I guess it looks like the Conservatives at least will not be showing up for those consortium debates. The other parties get to decide, first of all, whether the offer is still out there if the incumbent prime minister is not participating, and secondly, whether they want to attend. You know, that's the Conservatives for their own reasons. It contrasts with, for instance, the behavior of Elizabeth May of the Green Party, who is saying yes to any invitation she gets, and of Tom Mulcair of the NDP, who, if I'm not mistaken, has accepted every invitation that's gone his way so far. But what it will come down to in the debates is the quality of the questions, the quality of the interaction, and we're going to work hard to make sure that we make sure everyone pulls their weight at this debate by having to answer hard questions about their positions on the issues.
How are you going to, when you get the chance to really frame this debate for Maclean's, how are you going to do it? Are you going to have single leaders battle off each other? Is it just going to be one moderator? I think you put it when I talked to you last about this, if they don't answer the question, I'm going to chase them around the room until they do. So what are you hoping to get out of this?
The smallest possible amount of sort of overhead, studio crowds, questions beamed in from elsewhere, multiple moderators taking turns. We want a sort of a light, agile format in which the leaders respond to one another, and in which the moderator has a chance to go and tidy up any loose ends by making sure the questions that had not been addressed get addressed, that leaders who haven't been able to get a word in edgewise get a chance to speak, and things like that. So basically the a lean and mean debate, or, well, a lean debate.
Okay, so with the consortium move by the Conservatives, I mean, let's face it, the consortium really does have the largest, in terms of television, the largest viewership you could possibly ask for with three of the major networks mm-hmm. involved. So is it a right move for them to turn that down given the viewership? And then also, does that Conservative move throw a wrench in the gears for the plans of the opposition parties?
I'm pretty sure that anyone who wants to see any of these debates will be able to see these debates through their laptop computer or on any of the many television channels that are likely to carry them. In Alberta, in the recent election, the only debate that was held was run by Global News, and people in Alberta, a large and diverse province, seemed to be able to not only to see the debate but to draw some pretty important conclusions from what they saw in the debate. In Quebec, there have been both, you know, broad consortium-led debates and individual debates led by a single proponent. So this is not unprecedented. What we're proposing, what Bloomberg and what other proponents are proposing, doesn't throw a wrench in the strategies of the various parties. Three parties have decided it doesn't particularly because they're going to show up for our debate. And I actually have every confidence that we'll get a full house. We'll get all four. On the other hand, you know, to the extent that it's a surprise in terms of the long-term planning of several of these parties, election campaigns are going to throw a lot of wrenches into their plans. And they might as well start rehearsing by dealing with the one we've thrown.
All right, and just before we move on to a new topic, the plan is to have it put on as many formats as possible run by Rogers. So that would be Maclean's, Rogers Radio likely, and City TV. Is that correct?
And Omni Television. And we've got an agreement that CPAC is going to carry the signal too.
Excellent. Wonderful. So let's talk now about the environment. On Friday, at the end of the week, the Conservatives unveiled what otherwise would be a major announcement. Usually bad news gets released on Friday, but for the conservatives, this is an ambitious goal for environmental targets. And they've been criticized over, you know, almost every year that they've been in power about environmental targets. And now they're saying their goal is to reduce emissions by 30% from 2005 levels by the year 2030. What do you make of this? Is this a goal that's actually achievable?
Sure. If you have a full court press and very aggressive emissions controls to meet that thing, but to meet that target, but there's no evidence that this federal government has ever had the intention to do that sort of thing. Basically, they've set more ambitious targets further out than the ones they're already certain to miss. The emission target for 2020, they're going to miss it by dozens of megatons of carbon emissions. And so they're going to say, well, we'll do better 10 years further down the line. This is at least the third series of targets that a Canadian federal government has set. The Conservatives, when they were elected in 2006, inherited liberal Kyoto targets, which the liberal governments of Chrétien and Martin had done very little to try to meet. And the Conservatives continued in that embarrassing tradition. Conservatives set up their own targets for 2020 and have gotten close to nowhere in terms of meeting them. And now they've set more targets for 2030. It's to the point now where the Conservatives criticize just about any move that any provincial government does to constrain their carbon emissions growths. And then they incorporate provincial progress in meeting their targets as part of the national effort. So if a provincial government implements a carbon tax or a cap and trade scheme or does anything to constrain emissions, you get the federal government saying, what a dumb idea, and they're going to help us meet our targets. So I'm not sure that's great federalism.
So it doesn't sound like you have a lot of faith in them hitting their targets, or at least taking the initiative to hit those targets. If that's the case, then what is this? Is this just for the election to say, you know, if they're ever questioned about the environment, yeah, we have a policy, look at this.
So it's two things. First of all, there's the Paris conference towards the end of the year, in which every industrialized country is going to be expected to come up with an emissions target and emissions plans, and so that's just sort of the cost of entry for a conference that I'm not sure the Prime Minister is very enthusiastic about. And then secondly, it is anyone with sort of chronic bad behavior always promises to turn over a new leaf down the road, and I think this government may honestly believe that it'll get easier to reduce carbon emissions further down the road, and may honestly sort of kind of want to meet these things. And to the extent they don't, they've just bought themselves 10 more years before people start to pay serious attention to whether they are. So I think their motives are mixed.
All right. Thanks very much, Paul. Really appreciate it. Paul Wells, the political editor for Maclean's Magazine. And I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.